Good afternoon. Thank you all for being here today. My name is Cristina Caldas. I'm the president of Cyber Foundation, a Cambridge-based educational and scientific nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting meaningful cultural and cooperative exchanges between the United States and Brazil. You've just watched a pocket show by Flavio Lira. Thank you, Flavio, for being here. A talented Brazilian musician, composer, arranger, producer, currently attending Berklee College of Music. Pessoa magazine brings us here today to celebrate the vigor of Brazilian literature. This is the first session ever dedicated to Brazilian literature at the Boston Book Festival, and we are all very excited about that. It is also the world premiere of the English version of an anthology, bringing together more than 20 of the best representatives of Brazil's literature. Edited by Leonardo Tonus, a professor of literature at Paris Sorbonne University, the anthology opens up a diverse world that we invite you to explore. At the end of the session, you may buy the English electronic version of the anthology, available for download on Kindle. This event was organized by Mirna Queiroz from Pessoa Magazine, with support of Rosabelle Coelho Queixa, Rosabelle, thank you, from the MIT Brazil program, Nilma Dominique, MIT Global Studies and Languages, Nilma, thank you, Boston Literary District, Eve Bridgeberg, Deborah Potter and staff, Boston University, Pardee School of Global Studies and Latin American Studies and Romance Studies, Celia Bianconi, thank you, and Elizabeth Emrian, and also by Cyber Foundation. On stage, you will meet three outstanding writers. They're there waiting for us. Nuno Ramos, Alexandre Vidal Porto, and Luisa Geisler. Thank you all for coming also. Their work will be read by Paulo Barroso. Thank you, Paulo. Associate Professor of Law at Boston College. The mediator is Nilma Dominique, and I hand over the floor now to Nilma. Enjoy the session.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here. Today is a very special day indeed because, as Cristina said, it's the first time that the Boston Book Festival houses a panel on Brazilian literature, a literature that, as many other Brazilian manifestations, is diverse, is creative, is unique, but at the same time, it's also universal. And we are very, very happy to have with us three great representatives of Brazilian contemporary literature. Please help me to welcome Alexandre Vidal Porto, Luisa Geisler, and Nuno Ramos. Well, it's a pleasure to be with you. So let me introduce them first. Alexandre, who is next to me. Alexandre Vidal Porto is a writer and a diplomat. He is a columnist for Folha de São Paulo and a Harvard-trained lawyer and human rights activist. His first novel, Matias na Cidade, Matias in Town, was published in 2005 to critical acclaim. His second, Sérgio Wai, was awarded the Paraná Literary Prize and is scheduled to be published here in the U.S. in a few months in the spring by Europe Editions. Luisa Geisler was only 19 when she was awarded the 2010 Prêmio Sesc de Literatura, Sesc Prize for Literature, for her debut book, a collection of short stories called Contos de Mentira, Fake Short Stories. She won again the following year with the book Quizá, Perhaps. In 2012, she was the youngest author to be included in Granda's Best Young Brazilian Writers, a collection of short stories published by the prestigious magazine. And Nuno Ramos has made his mark as a writer of poetry, novels, songs, essays, in journalistic work. He's author of Cujo, O Pão do Corvo, Ensaio Geral, O Mal Vidraceiro, and O, published in 2009, which won the prestigious Portugal Telecom Prize. But Nuno Ramos is also an artist, esteemed for his paintings, installations, sculptures, and photography, as well as a filmmaker. He has received numerous prizes for his work in different mediums, including the Grand Award of the Bernard and Anna Lee Newman Foundations for his creative whole as for his creative work as a whole. So, welcome. We are going to talk a little bit, we're going to chat, and then you're going to give the audience the opportunity to ask questions if you wish to do so. We'd like to thank also Professor Paulo Barroso, because he's going to be here reading the fragments of the author's books. So thank you so much, Paulo. Well, the title of this panel is The Vigor of Brazilian Literature. So I would like to start asking you, what is the vigor of Brazilian literature, and what's the, do you believe, is the current situation of the literature in Brazil? Yes, yes, of course.
Yeah, so good afternoon, everybody. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for having come. Well, the vigor of Brazilian literature, in my opinion, it lies in its diversity. In Revista Pessoa, for instance, you'll be able to see a vast array of writers of, you know, every part of Brazil talking about the most different subjects in the most different ways. But as far as the U.S. audiences are concerned, I think that the vigor of the Brazilian literature lies in its identity with the what's doing, or lies in the identity between the two countries, in the sense that they are not, Brazil and the U.S. are the two largest Western multi-ethnic democracies. You don't have any other countries that have such, you know, similar ethnic and social makeups. We both share the legacy of slavery that we've been tackling ever since. And I think that this can be seen in the Brazilian, all the expressions, but in literature especially. So for the U.S. reader, a West reader, could see himself or could understand problems that he or she are tackling here, but, you know, that are being tackled in Brazil in a different way by a different person, but we're still talking about the same problem. So in the same way that we could learn from what's being discussed in what's being written here in the U.S. today, the U.S. audiences could profit very well of what's being written there. So I think it could be, I mean, enlightening, and that's why I think you guys should not miss out on us.
I think so too, actually, but also I think we have a strong vigor in contemporary literature, because if we take literature from other centuries, we don't have such variety as we have today. It's very interesting, because if you take literature from other centuries, you have maybe very inspired by European literature, and nowadays we have a larger expression. We have authors that are Brazilian and are trying to write Brazilian literature, so that's very interesting also. And I think the contemporary literature is doing that the most, and I think that that's where our vigor is, because it became more democratic to become a writer in Brazil. Brazil is a very elitist country, so if nowadays it's easier to be a writer, it's not very easy, but it's easier. So we have several voices. We have the voices from the favela, and we have the voices from the urban parts of the country, and we have... So Brazil is a big country, and that diversity that's present in the contemporary literature, it's less elitist, can I say that?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. So I think that's very interesting, and I think contemporary literature has that vigor nowadays more than it had in the past, because it's more accessible. So I think
it's more representative, right?
Yes, it's more representative, yeah. Precisely.
So if you take just what who we are, like you have us a straight man, you know, young woman from southern Brazil, known as from Rio, I'm assuming. You as a black woman from Salvador, I'm a gay man from the Northeast. So, and we are, we're picked up at random.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that says something.
And for instance, to me, I'll just open a small parenthesis, but to me, I discovered literature through Argentina because I began reading Cortázar and also Borges. So it's interesting the process that Brazilian literature has with these influences. So I think our vigor lies contemporarily. So that's my final answer.
Wonderful. Thank you. Well, hi, I'm Nuno. Thank you for coming. My English is worse than theirs.
We can help. We'll help.
Yeah. Well, I agree with them, and they have said almost all I wanted to say, but I would just add a little observation that literature in Brazil has always organized our culture since the 19th century, I mean. So we had big names and big poets, big novelists, essayists, and this corpus of writers and of works was organized. I think after the 80s, this changed a lot. And nobody really knows nowadays who is the big guy and who is the main author, the more important poet. I mean, this is, of course, something dangerous because if you really have a magnificent artist, it only helps. But it's also something very nice because, everybody's kind of equal. The super ego is not so intense in a situation like this. And so I think maybe this lack of organization in terms of clear names is profitable for art. I mean, it's also a situation where you don't have so much pressure from the past of, I don't know. And so I think we are kind of living this moment in Brazil with many new voices and this feeling that, you know, like a diaspora, how do you say this?
Diaspora
of voices, you know, coming from everywhere and nobody really knows what to do with this, and this is interesting, I feel.
Yeah, we have some authors that have more attention, but there's not like a hierarchy, you know, and it's very, how can I say this, it's very cooperative. So you have Luiz Rufato, for instance, who is a very famous and well-translated author. I mean, but he's also he organizes anthologies internationally, so he reads contemporary literature and he makes dialogues with that. So I think that has a lot to do with this. It's not such a hierarchy with like a king writer or something, but it has more of a dialogue and it's more cooperative, I think. There is also this side of cooperation.
And some, I think that there are like more channels for people to voice their expression. No, not always you get like one of the commercial big publishing companies, but you can always write a blog, you can always do something, and that has been very, very good for Brazilians in terms of their self-expression and artistic expression.
Very good. Alexandre, let's talk about your latest book that's going to be published soon.
Yes.
Here, Sérgio Wai. Yes. Can you talk a little bit what it's
about? Sérgio Wai. Also, like I'll do my advertisement. Sérgio Wai is going to be out in spring 2016. It's already on pre-order, so if you like, and there is like a special offer like granted for the ones present here. If you buy the book, if you don't like the book, you just get in touch with me on any kind of social media, and you can choose as a reimbursement, the title, you know, you can get like a Luisa's title, I'll send it to you.
Yeah.
But basically the book book is a story as told by a 70-year-old therapist, psychotherapist, a professor emeritus that has been used to being right. And this guy is telling the story of his 17-year-old patient who all of a sudden quits treatment and unbeknownst to the doctor, this guy moves to New York to live a new and hopefully better life in New York as a woman. And this is all told in retrospect. And I mean, the book has been like, so far has had a nice career. I think it's a good story. It touches this theme of transgender, but mainly it's a book about identity. It's a book about a sense of possibility of, you know, if you don't like the life you have now, you can always have a second shot somewhere else. You know, if happiness is not next to you, go fetch it, because it's there and it's for you to try to reach it. So that the title in Portuguese is Sergio Y Goes to America, because the idea of America, of promised land, or, you know, I can do better in a second, in an America, like Elia Kazan, America, is very present. But in the Y, my editors prefer to have just Sergio Y, since he had already gone to America. Basically, that's the story. It's a story about identity, about sexual identity, but mainly about the possibility of being happy, you know, of having a second chance in life if the first one you got was not exactly what you wanted.
So. And it seems that you like tackling psychological issues. How do you choose them?
It's funny because, you know, I will say something that perhaps I shouldn't, but I will just be candid. But like during a certain time, I had a prejudice against psychology.
Oh,
and now I think that psychology is perhaps the most relevant of the, you know, branches of human knowledge. I think that you can explain much more than we think through psychology. But basically, I think that in the case of Sergio Armando, is the narrator, this therapist, I'm not talking about only psychology, but I'm talking about medicine. He's an MD, and also about the superpowers that we think a doctor sometimes had, you know, like an overpower, like a superpower of healing, etc.
But yeah, this, like godlike. Almost.
Exactly, godlike quality to doctors. And no, doctors make mistakes. Doctors are human, but maybe because I'm an atheist. I'm not religious, rather. And so I think that I try to explain, unsuccessfully, of course, this basic tenets of human condition, like happiness, pain, desire, fear, through science, you know, and then that's where psychology comes. But as I said, you know, eu não creio em bruxas, pero que las hay, las hay. You know, I don't trust, you know, like, but there must be something, because I'm not successful to explain anything through science.
And how do you choose the title of your book, or at least the subject?
The subject, I don't choose stories, I choose characters. So basically, there is a poem by Walt Whitman, Crossing Brooklyn Ferry, that is in the epigraph of this book and has a lot to do with like the conversations between generations, which is something that this book is about too. And he says something, well, like this poem, Crossing Brooklyn Ferry, probably, or perhaps some of you are familiar with this poem, but it was Walt Whitman every day. I mean, he would cross from Brooklyn to Manhattan. I mean, he lived in Brooklyn, worked in Manhattan. There was no Brooklyn Bridge then. And he would cross, take this Brooklyn ferry every morning, and he would just get exposed to all the elements, like the tides, the lights, the seagulls, and all the people that are, you know, crossing with him. And in this poem, he says, "You that are crossing with me, you are more important to me and more present in my meditations than you can suppose." And I really identify with that, you know, because I'm talking to a person and then I get totally into this person's universe, and I just get, I, 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 I start from a moment, a paralyzed moment of reality. Let's say I'm super interested in you, Luisa.
Yeah.
And then I take this picture of Luisa that interests me a lot, and then I tackle it. And wherever it will lead me, it will lead me. I don't like to have control over what I'm writing. But I do know who I want to write about.
Yeah, if I may interrupt. That's a very interesting thing to me, too, because the possibility of being other people and other realities, that's, number one, very Brazilian because of our diversity, and also a little bit of empathy. Brazilian people are very empathetic, can I say that? But also, it's very interesting to me being other people. I consider myself a little boring, so I love being other people. It's so interesting. This award that I won, it's called Prêmio Sesc de Literatura. It's a manuscript award. So you send your book with a pseudonym. Is that it? Like a fake name. And you send it. And if you win, they will say who won, who actually won.
A pseudonym.
Yeah, precisely.
Yes.
So I sent my book. And after I won, I went to a panel with one of the judges. Like, I was watching the panel, and I was going to talk to her because I was going to thank her, et cetera, et cetera. And then when I presented myself, she was like, oh my God, I didn't think you were a girl. I thought you were a gay man in your 40s who's a screenwriter. She had a very precise image of who I was because I had a fake name. She didn't know me. So that's very interesting to me. Being other people and using other possibilities. I'll explain more of that throughout the panel. But that's very interesting to me, being other people and using other identities, because that the humanity of it is very, very deep. And I think we are all carrying our own stories, and that's literature to me also. So that's just a small interruption.
So now I'm very interested to know, why did you use the male pseudonym?
Oh, yeah, it was a male pseudonym. Both times.
In both cases. Yeah.
Yeah, I sent the book to the manuscript award. I sent two books to the manuscript award in two following years, like 2010, 2011. I used the male pseudonym because I may lose like part of the audience just by saying this word, but I'm a feminist. and that to me is really important. And at the time, I thought that it would be more, how can I say, judged more neutrally if I use the male pseudonym, because if I use the female name, I would be a female author. If I use the male name, I would be an author. There's a, you know, being a female becomes an adjective, and while being a man is just the norm of the role. So that to me, at the time I didn't have such a, like a theoretical understanding of it, because it was a while ago and I was just beginning in college. But that to me was really important, to be understood as an author, and just an author. After that, I realized that I was not only being a female author, I was being a young female author, and that was a recurring topic in interviews. Like, what is it like being a young author? I don't really know, because that's the only experience I've had as an author, being a young author. So I guess I used the male pseudonym because of that, because I wanted a neutral judgment. I didn't want to be a female. But I'm glad I now can use my own name, because I kind of like it better that way. You know.
So let's now listen to a fragment of Sérgio Y.
Sérgio
Y, yes.
So we have time only for a little appetizer, so I hope you don't feel dirty.
Don't forget the offer, you know. Orders placed on October 24th.
Alexandre Vidal Porto, Tupi's widow. Translated by Zoe Berry.
Excuse me. So this is not from Sérgio Y. This is a short story that that opens this Revista Pessoa anthology that we are presenting today.
Tupi's widow. Throughout our marriage, I often speculated about which of us would die first. Now I know. On a regular day, he would wake up before me. He would take a shower, shave, and return to the bedroom. He would pour water from the pitcher on the dresser, and then I would awaken to a glass of water and the first pills of the day, which he delivered to me on a saucer. I will no longer have days like those. My husband died, and waking up without him around feels different. It's like moving a sore muscle, almost like waking up with a stiff neck. You close your eyes and want to lie still, motionless, in a position that won't hurt. If you lose control and make any movement, it aches. Waking up is the worst part of my day. It was Tupi who should have been widowed. He was the one who should have lost his spouse, not me. I'm the one with the heart disease. When the doctor told me I had a blockage in the trunk of my coronary artery, we were sitting hand in hand, and his hand gave mine a squeeze. I was the one who was supposed to die first.
So, yeah. Just one more question for you, Alexandre. Your chapters are usually very quick, short, yeah. And it helps to capture the reader's attention. So how would you describe your style?
Well, I have two reasons for this. I would say three reasons for this question of style. First reason is because I don't want to take up more time of the reader than I deserve. So I try to be I work heavily on my text, I edit heavily because I don't want to give anything that is superfluous, anything that my reader will not need. And I'm not underestimating my reader. So I think that, if I think that what I'm giving is sufficient for the reader to transcend with me, that's what I try to do. I don't want he or she to be like more time with me than, they have children, they have their own lives to care. Just want whichever time is necessary. This is the first one. The second one, I think I lived in the U.S. for a long time, and English for a long time was a kind of a language of escape that I had. I was very shy. I had no friends. And I got, at age 9, I got pen friends through a company
website?
Or like an organization in Turku, Finland. And I remember at age 9, I got this Christine Shia was her name. She lived in Quezon City, the Philippines. And she was the first of several foreign pen friends that I made over the years. I had a correspondence with the Japanese girl for 25 years, and always in English. So English was a language of expression to me. And syntax in English is different from the traditional syntax in Portuguese. So I think that in a certain way, my Portuguese syntax has become English-sized or Anglicized on the construction level, which I like, because then we get to the third point. As like, I'm very political. I do social activism all the time. I'm a difficult person. They're always complaining, always fighting. And my literature is political. I think that if I were Norwegian, I would have a totally different approach. I would be doing different things. But being a Brazilian, I feel a responsibility of granting access to my literature. So I don't want to exclude anybody. Why should I write complicated things that a person that's, intelligent, totally able person should be able to understand with a simple word. I don't have to complicate things more. So this, in a way, is to embrace as large an audience as possible. If I were Norwegian, let's say, if 90% of my countrymen had a PhD or something, maybe I would write something different. I would indulge myself more. But I think that being a Brazilian entails a certain kind of social responsibility, and I take this responsibility very close to my heart. So this is seen in my literature, I hope.
Very good. Luisa, your third book, your latest one, is Luzes de Emergência se acenderão automaticamente. The emergency lights will turn on automatically. And can you talk a little bit about it?
Sure. Emergency, I'll call it just emergency lights because the title is so long. I just call it, it's like emergency the emergency lights would turn on automatically. I would use all the times in the panel just saying the title. But the book is about a young man in suburban Brazil. But it's not like, suburbs is not the right word. He lives close to the capital, but in a...
kind of a sprawling community.
Yeah, yeah. He lives in a city. We call it
in the suburbs.
Yeah, it's the suburbs. But I think suburbs is kind of middle class. It's kind of it's the opposite. It's like in
periphery.
Okay. Anyways, okay. Yeah. Doesn't really matter that much. He lives in like a city in the suburbs. But his best friend goes into a coma because of a very ridiculous accident. He just falls from something, hits his head, is in a coma. And this young man's way to approach the problem is writing letters to the friend. He writes letters as if he was just making a software, and when his friend woke up, he would just install all the new information and everything would be fine. You know, his way of dealing with reality is acting as if, oh, I'll fix this. I'll fix whatever. You know, my friend's in a coma, I'll tell him everything that's going on. When he wakes up, he'll read it, we'll just become friends again. You know, his way of dealing with it is kind of denying it through those letters. And the book deals with this, but also deals with the main character's girlfriend. She, at some point, she gets pregnant. I'm sorry, spoilers. But at some point, she gets pregnant, and she tries to have an abortion, and abortions in Brazil are illegal, so that's complicated. There's a bit of a underground abortion world. Sorry. It's not that underground or anything, but it has a little bit of that. And the main character, at the same time, he starts getting involved with a man, and the main character is very homophobic with himself, so in the letters to his friend, he talks about it, but I tried to show a little bit of how he was rejecting what was happening. He was always trying to undermine what was happening and trying to say, oh, it's not that important. But at the same time, what he was showing instead of what he was saying something, but he was showing something different. So the book involves this sort of drama at some point. And the book is a little bit about that. It's a little bit about youth in Brazil. It's a little bit about this not very exact middle class that's suddenly appearing in Brazil, but it has a lot to do with that. This character wouldn't normally have access to many privileges or universities, so he goes to university through some sort of student loan given by the government, which is a new thing. So it kind of deals with those new aspects of this growing
Brazilian society.
Yes, precisely.
Enlarging of the... empowering of the Brazilian middle class.
Yeah, because this character wouldn't originally... He's not very intellectual. He doesn't come from a very privileged family, if I may say so. So there's a lot of that throughout the book. And I guess that it's about that. It's about this humanity and confusion. And it's a very interesting book to me because of the whole being another person again. Because what I liked most about writing the book was this whole thing about showing something and saying something different. So I'm in a way betting on my reader's intelligence that he will see that what he's saying and what he's showing is completely different. It's like someone who's shaking or sweating a lot and how do I say gaguejar in English?
So stuttering.
Stuttering, exactly. Thank you. So someone who's stuttering, and then this person is stuttering, but he's saying, oh, I'm very confident, you know? So the book is a little bit about the impact between those two things. And that was the most interesting to me. I think it has a lot to do with developing the character, and he has a very particular language throughout the letters, because at the beginning he's very formal and he uses punctuation very correctly, but as the coma goes on and his friend doesn't show much signs of recovery, he at some point just gives up, and he, in Portuguese we say, he turns on the fuck it, like ele liga foda-se.
Give a fuck.
Yeah, he just fuck it all. Yeah. And he starts just, the punctuation gets worse, and the book deals a lot with showing and saying, and I think that's the whole play with the in the book, and it was my intention. I don't know if that's very clear. I'm sorry for cursing. I don't know if
let's
I can
listen to a fragment. I think
oh, yeah,
it's
the fragment has cursing too, so
let's listen to a fragment.
So hurt. The emergency lights will turn on automatically by the use of Geisler, translated by Anna Fletcher. Canoas, 12 December 2011. Hey man, we both hate Canoas, the name of the city. We both hate Canoas. Must be because of all this stuff we have shared. I think it's because the city's slogan is fly canoas, fly canoe. Without a comma. Yeah, I know, I know. It's because of the airplane, symbol of the city, the importance of aeronautics to the city's development, the airplane capital. I think it must also have something to do with the fact that Dona Zila would always have a go at me for never using commas before names. And there is that fucking airplane in the town square, fly canoas. That sentence makes no sense on any level, you know? Canoes don't fly. Canoes don't fly, for fuck's sake. Man, you know what I mean, don't you? I think that's why I hate this city so much. Maybe it's because of the way we were treated. You were treated at the hospital in Canoas. You almost died. Okay, fine. You went into a coma, but that's not really any better, if you ask me. Then they transfer you to a hospital in Porto Alegre for the surgery, as if that was going to bring you back. Everything is bad in Porto Alegre. And they even lied to you about that, because Porto Alegre didn't change a fucking thing. That's right. I think that's why I hate this city so much. That and picturing a canoe with little wings, I'm tired of this place. You were tired of this place. I'm going to visit you when I'm done at the service station. It will be like the third time, maybe. Ike.
It's very interesting that it's your third book, your second novel, because your first book was a collection of short stories, but it's actually the first book that you write not for compete in a prize, not to submit for the SESC prize. How was the writing process? Was different in both cases?
Yes, I think so, because like I said, my first two books, they had, I sent it to a manuscript award, so it wasn't me, technically. And if I won, it would be me, but if not, it had no impact.
You were protected, yeah.
Yeah,
your
I was
identity,
protected,
yeah, you're
precisely.
Invisible, yes.
Yeah, exactly. I wasn't, there was no pressure.
From rejection.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Because if I were rejected, only I would know. So it was a very, very interesting process. But also both books had very little editing.
And you won both prizes, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
On both categories. Yeah. It has a short story category and a novel category.
Yeah.
So the books, they went through, after they won the award, they went through a revision, but mostly grammatic and orthography.
Yes.
Proofreading, basically. Proofreading, but... And they were published mostly as I wrote them. I didn't have the time. And also the publishing house couldn't edit much of it. So nowadays I read my first book, which is Contos de Mentira, which is a short stories book. And I read some stories and I think, well, maybe this one shouldn't be published. This one I could change.
Let me ask you something. Just
okay, sure.
Do you feel embarrassed? I mean, because sometimes I read things that I read, that at the time, at a certain point I loved and I felt, wow, this was great.
Yes.
And then now I don't want people to read because I'm so embarrassed. And I said, no, that was not me. I think it was just channeling someone or, it's not me. You feel that like that as well?
I get that all the time because the book didn't have much editing. And I read something, and I'm...
And of course, that we put the blame on the editors, you
see. Yeah, the publishing house.
No,
I was
publishing
very young,
yeah, exactly,
Very young, old days, something like that. So writing Emergency Lights was a very interesting experience for that, because I got to talk with an editor and I could talk to him about his work. And I'm very, very insecure. So this editor is the editor for Granta magazine in Brazil. So he was one of the people that chose me to go into the Best Young Novelist. So I trust that he likes my work. And I don't have that with everyone, and I don't have that with many editors. So when he says something, I take it seriously. So we have a very strong relationship with the whole writing thing. So that was great. And the current novel I'm working on, we have an even closer relationship, because I'm sending the books in
parts.
Yeah, precisely. The book has four parts, and I'm sending each part to him so he can participate. And that's really great, because most of the times I had friends, sometimes not even very academic friends. I had like a friend who enjoys reading, and then she'd give me opinions. So Emergency Lights had a great, great edition, and we could talk, my editor could talk about things, and oh, this character doesn't work so well, or if I had any questions about things, I knew I could talk to him. So at some point, next girlfriend kind of goes away, you know, she kind of doesn't appear anymore to the story, because my character doesn't see her anymore, and it's not the abortion one, it's another, someone is
actually... if I may interrupt, because you mentioned something that I'm like, now that I'm launching a novel here, and I mean, I went through the process of publishing in Brazil and publishing here, and mm-hmm. it's totally different, this question of editing.
Yes.
Because I don't know if that's good or bad. I particularly think it's bad, because I do my tax benefit from editing.
Yes.
But everybody's tax benefit mm-hmm. from, but you know, but in Brazil, many editors seem to think that they would be interfering with your artistic freedom, and then many times you present a novel and the novel gets printed. It doesn't published in the sense that it goes through editing and everything. No, you go there and, oh, I like this, so let's print it. Print, and then you have a book, and of course that, you know, the book is not as good as it could have been, because a part of the, and here in the States, it's very refreshing to feel that you go through editing, and then, you know, like you have galleys. The book is going to be out in last week in April, and the galleys are going to be ready next week. This, in the Brazilian publishing market, is completely out of any...
Do you get editing, even if it's a translation? Because, for instance, in Brazil, if you're translating something, the editor doesn't change it that much, because the book has already been edited somewhere.
But this is just an excuse for, you know, for not working
editing.
Hard. Because basically... That's true, you know, like a work of translation. Let's do Google Translation. It's not like that. You have to you need some human quality to that.
Yeah, but there's a part of editing that's not so focused on language. There's a part of editing that's like, okay, this character is not working.
Oh, no, but it's not the...
Yeah, do you get this editing here too?
No, I get the editing to be like the
most...
The
conversation is very good.
I'm sorry.
We can talk about it later.
We'll talk about it later, yes.
But I have a quick question to Nuno. Nuno, you are considered a hybrid artist. I have to read the list of activities you do. You are a painter, a sculptor, writer, filmmaker, set designer, a music composer, etc., etc., etc. But in an interview, you said that, above all, you are a visual artist. So my question is, how did you become interested in literature, and what does the literature mean in your life?
Thank you. Well, I was meant to be a writer, not an artist. I had a kind of a crisis with this. I don't know, I can't describe it in Portuguese, so I can't describe it in English. When I was, 17 or something, I began writing very young. Maybe 11, I don't know. I really wanted to be a poet or something like this. And then I felt that words were too abstract, and that, you know, I didn't, although I was trained to be a writer, and I was not trained to be an artist. I mean, I have some technique as a writer, and I don't have as an artist. I don't know how to draw. I don't know anything as a visual artist. But then I felt that maybe the materiality of the visual art stuff, I mean, something out of my body that, you know, I always say that if you can lie with words, but it's much more difficult to lie with Vaseline and sand and iron. If you do lie, you may kill someone because it falls down, you know. So I was very attracted by this physical component of art. And when I start writing again, maybe 3 or 4 years after I stopped, I felt that words were kind of physical for me, and I started to connect with this. I do a lot of things, but I don't really think you choose much. It's difficult to answer to that question because maybe people think that, you know, an artist is in the middle of nowhere and then he thinks, what shall I do? And then he stops. But it doesn't happen that way because it's a very concrete and situated position the artist has, because he has his own tools, his own stylistic tools, and they are not so many. I mean, I think I do lots of things, and even when I write, I mix a lot of language because I can't do it. I only can do this if I had a more psychological deepness. I would go for it. If I had another sense of life different from mine, I would love to be another person. And that's what art is about, always, to be another person, to be in another guy's mind or animal mind or vegetable or, I don't know, sand mind.
Yeah, but to leave your own position.
Yeah, to leave your own position. That's the best. Maybe that's the only thing that's really good in art. Because the pressure, you know,
that's
is...
That's true. That's a good thing.
Yeah. Because the pressure is so, you know, your art is so connected. The failure is so big. But, you know, the feeling that, you know, you have accessed something that's not you.
That you created something different from you.
Yeah, different from you. And different from what you did in your last work. And it's so, that's so marvelous. And maybe we are being very positive with Brazil. And I want to be very positive with Brazil now. And maybe this lack of institutional pressure in Brazil is something nice, you know, because you really have the feeling that you can do everything. Because even in they were having a very interesting conversation that was about editing, but if you see it larger, about critics. Mm-hmm. And in Brazil, you know, I lived all my life in a very severe critic context. But this context was not, it was also made by critics, but it was most than anything made by friends, people that read you or that went to your studio. And this was so impressively important for me. And I think, you know, contemporary life has kind of lost this connection with critic. Not with critics or curators, which are now very mixed, or publishing guys, very mixed with power, with
market,
money, with mark, la, 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 with numbers and statistics, and I don't know what. But this feeling that somebody that you really give him the key to something that is important to you, he comes to your studio or he reads what you write, and then, you know, he really wants you to be more than you have been. There's some erotic thinking critics also that we are missing.
You have just a few minutes, but yeah. I don't want
I'm
to
sorry.
Finish. No, that's wonderful, and you're going to have a chance to talk a little bit after the panel is over. But I'd like Paulo to read the fragment of your book,
Oh, by Nuno Ramos, translated by Chris Abreu. I do not tire of touching her. first with the tip of my fingers, then with the palms of my hands. For a few moments, I even content myself with directing set phrases and groans to her. But soon, I pass to the second stage, making her materialize in front of me through touch. Perhaps for knowing profoundly, that all one offers is fading and dying. I know that I have to reach her before she disappears. Nonetheless, she is now quite clear before me, as has happened for many years, and does not know that she is disappearing. Only I know, I'm certain. With the light of the street lamp, with the smoke of water that boils, with the sound of a bird in the middle of the clamor, I compare her, with the brief life of an insect, with the shape of a cloud.
I don't know how strict we are in time, but we'd like to hear from you. Great. If you have any questions, I have a lot. So I want to hear. Excuse me, there is one person here in the... the others came.
So my question has to do with how involved you are with your translations and your translators. Is this something where you're, communicating back and forth and you are working very closely with them, or do you give them kind of free range and just trust that they're going to render it into English?
Anyone of you?
So,
I have a. It depends a lot. For instance, my emergency lights is being translated into Spanish to be published in Argentina, and I know the translator for a very long time. She's the one that translates most of the things I write into Spanish. So we're friends. We're very close friends. So we can talk very openly about the translation because I speak Spanish, she speaks Portuguese. So we can find connections. And since I live in southern Brazil, we sometimes have a lot of fun with this because there's expressions that only exist in southern Brazil. They're kind of Spanish, but they exist, for instance, in southern Brazil and in Argentina and nowhere else. So sometimes we have some fun with that. But, for instance, the English translation, I barely know it. I see it and I review it and I answer questions, but it's much more formal and it's not like the Spanish translation in which we can talk about it and have a beer and laugh. So it depends a lot on the relationship with the translator. I like to see it, but I don't want to impose because sometimes I'm a translator from English to Portuguese, so I also know that translator is someone who wants to do a good job. So I don't want to impose, and I think it's kind of arrogant of me to think, oh no, I know what's best of this in English because, and so it depends a lot. It has to do with trust and kind of friendship, but also it has to do a lot of letting go also, and you got this. So, yeah.
Good. I mean, I think that it all depends on whether you know the language you're being translated into or not. But in any case, for instance, like right now I'm being translated into English and into Italian at the same time. I don't know anything Italian, except, the menu, carbonara, things. But other than that, my Italian is non-existent. So that is a question of trust. I trust my Italian translator, and when she hits a snag, she gets to me, but it's never a linguistic snag. It's always something dealing with meaning, or what did you really meant here, or how do you think we can translate this expression that has no equivalent in Italian? But then it's a language that I don't speak. Let's say English or Spanish or French that I kind of know better. Even so, I try not to mingle. First, I mean, the translators don't open up very much, you know. It's always like they call you when they hit a snag, when they have a question, because they may be just opening a Pandora's box, you know, that I'm talkative, and then, you know, like, oh, let's discuss the translations, and then I will have the idea to rewrite the book in English. So basically, the thing is, I think that you take the space that your translator allows for.
Yeah.
But they don't allow much. They just want to get in touch when they have a question.
Yeah, and also it has, I think translators are very careful readers, because sometimes I get a question of something that I never thought
about. Exactly, that's...
And there's like, oh, why did you use this verb? And the answer is, I don't know.
It was not me.
I have no idea.
It was not me.
And sometimes things, that they are very careful readers, I think even more than the proofreaders or anyone, because they have to work with that. So it's kind of funny, actually.
I love my translators.
I love all
my
translators. We kind of become friends. I don't know if they love me back, but I sure
exactly.
love them.
You know, I have been translated into Portuguese because I published it in Lisbon.
Oh.
And so it was very funny to know that I don't know Portuguese.
But you were like translated into Portuguese
from European Portuguese.
Yeah.
Portuguese.
It was so funny because little difference, but strong difference.
Yeah, big differences. Yeah. Of course.
That is another person.
Thank you. Luisa, I wanted to follow up on what you said earlier about how you were influenced by other Latin American writers. Specifically, you mentioned Cortázar and Borges. And I'm wondering, because I think maybe in this country, a lot of times there's this concept of Latin America being this like unified, you know, whole, when in fact everybody's nationalistic, and you have the Brazilians over here and the Colombians over here and the Peruvians over here. And, you know, with the exception of Brazil, the rest of Latin America speaks primarily Spanish, right? So I was wondering if you could expand on the idea of sort of the relationship between Brazilian literature and the rest of Latin America.
Yeah. I think also Alex must have an interesting point of view because he's a diplomat, but I'll give my perspective first. It's not very... I majored in international relations, but I'm not a diplomat. I'm just anyways, I think there is this language barrier is... It's also a cultural barrier, because if you think about it, we have a Portuguese sort of, how can I say this, a Portuguese, what's the word, colonization?
Is that it?
Okay, yeah. And so there is this barrier. So if you think about it, Latin America is much more connected than Brazil is to, you know, how can I say, Spanish America is much more connected with itself than Brazil is to the rest of us. That's a thing that's been changing, but there is still... kind of, some people say that Brazil has its back turned to...
And it does.
Yeah, to Spanish America, because... and that's something that's been changing. But my relationship with it is very literary. I discovered... how can I say this? When I live in southern Brazil, so we're gauchos. Just like Argentinians are gauchos, but we are also gauchos.
Uruguayans.
Yeah, yeah. Precisely, the whole southern... very southern South America. So when I was little, I was taught that we were gauchos, we were not Brazilians. And for a very long time, there was this separation, and we...
Her state is kind of a secessionist state. Yeah. It's always like talking about breaking
very much
free.
Like Texas, for instance.
Yeah.
Anyways, so there was this thing, and there's always been this kind of... conversation that we should separate, etc., etc., etc. So I began my kind of literary globalization through Argentina and Latin America because it seemed closer to me.
Yeah, and in fact it is.
Yeah.
It seemed that it is.
Because in Brazil there is a hate towards Argentina that Rio Grande do Sul, which is my state, doesn't have so much. I don't know why. But I began through there, and then I had, then I discovered Brazil through literature, but first I discovered Spanish America. So,
But one thing that I think that makes, would, let's say, more or less set the divide or kind of set the chasm between, the cultural chasm between Latin America and Brazil, I think it's basically two things. One is, let's say, the strain, and forgive the choice of word, the strain of Catholicism that has taken over, the entirety of Latin America, from Mexico to Chile, except for, you know, all the Spanish-speaking world is much more Jesuitic, much more stern, much more moralistic, and then this kind of set the frame of mind of these cultures, of course, but we had something, and then we go back to what I said at first, that in Brazil we're not like a Latin American country, period. We are an Afro-Latin American country. And the Afro comes first because it is there first. And it's nothing more, I would say. Mm-hmm. I feel much more at ease with someone from Benin or someone from Benin or someone from West Africa than with someone from, let's say, an Andean culture. You know, it's much closer to my body language. It's much closer to my, being in the world. And I think that there are three countries in the continent that have this kind of makeup, this triangular makeup: Africa, strong Europe, and native populations, which are Brazil, this one country here, and Cuba, and let's say the Dominican Republic. But basically, it's the Cuba U.S. Brazilian connection, and that mm-hmm. defines us more than perhaps we realize, and much more than other people, I mean, other countries realize, right?
Yeah,
other
I think
cultures.
So. Yeah. But I was thinking that I, for instance, feel more at home at Montevideo, which is in Uruguay, or Buenos Aires, than at São Paulo, for instance. I understand the logistics more. It's really weird. Yeah, I understand how, I don't know.
I think we could stay here forever talking. But, well, they're going to stay around, so you can ask your questions direct to them. I would like to thank you all for being here again. Thank you so much, and congratulations on your great, outstanding job. Thank you. Thank you.